Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today happens to be one of those days that I've been waiting for a long time. We met physically at NOV some months back, but I just kind of bumped into you by the water thing that was leaking, and then I felt like I should say something significant and wasn't able to. So I think we just looked at that water leaking together. And now we're here, which is wonderful. You've been hugely influential to me. So it's an honor to have you on the podcast, Nora Bateson. Welcome.
Thank you, Amit. It's wonderful to be here. And I look forward to seeing where this goes today.
I gave you the sort of 30-second warning that this is what I tend to do. And I will stick to that. Initial question that I always ask my guests, and that is, who are you, Nora Bateson?
Who are you? Reminds me of the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland, who asks Alice that question. And Alice responds by saying, well, it's really hard to say because I keep changing all the time. Mm. And I can relate to that. It's a question that I feel quite passionate about from a sort of slightly different direction. Not because I'm eager to say who I am, but precisely because I'm eager to attend to the process of not falling into the traps of reductionism that it's easy to fall into as we introduce even ourselves. So for me in this moment, one of the, I think the most dangerous situations is, we have a big poly crisis of dangerous situations, ecological, economic, cultural, health, mental health, energy, agriculture. You can just keep going and going. My feeling is that all of these crises are work withable if we can do it together. Mm. But to do it together requires the kind of perception of possibility that would allow that. So who can I be when I'm with you is really different than the question of who are you. And it pulls me into an ecological way of thinking about how my tone, my way of being invites from you a way of being, which invites me to a way of being, which invites you to a way of being. And I think, I mean, to be honest, there's a lot of people who are doing great work out there on all of the broken institutions and broken governments and broken possibilities for mass response to these issues. Mm. I don't have really that much faith in that. So I think after decades of being in these questions, for me, that question that you're asking, who are you, is much more relevant because there you can't make a model to tell people how to live or how to think or how to feel. They will rebel. And at this point, we're living in a world of so much polarity. And while we're calling for collaboration and community and let's do this together, honestly, it's really inadequate because you can't have community without first communing. And that communing is only possible if I can begin to approach your way of being with the humility of knowing I don't know, and actually that you don't know who you are. And we don't know who we can be together. Yeah. So I wrote this piece, mm-hmm. called Self-Portrait.
Hmm.
Okay. And since you asked and you gave me permission to read, I will read it to you. So this is from Combining, and it's called Self-Portrait. If I were a mathematical formula, I would be a chalkboard full of symbols and arrows. Nope. I would be many such chalkboards, or maybe just a crayon writing 1 + 1 = with no answer. Wondering. Perhaps as a song, I would be a combining of something that resonates in thunderous bass tones with a lightness on top and a thumping beat. There would be a chorus of punk rock as well as a clear ping, ping of water on a ceramic bowl. Dancing. Or as a meal, I could be on some days a handmade feast of carefully overlapping tastes, textures, and temperatures, salty and sweet, spicy and bitter. Singe your tongue in one bite, cool drink of bubbly in the next. Other days, I'm reheated leftovers, soaking in yesterday's flavors. Reminding. As a weaving, I might have threads of moss and my beloved's hair, the purple plastic tassel from my bike when I was 9, the silk of longing and the itchy wool too, because life is many things, but not comfortable. Mm. I would be an elfish cloak that allows for air and magically keeps out the cold, wrapping you in love and ideas and giving you gumption to explore. Tending. I could be a painting with thick chunks of color and contrast, broad shapes that say bang, or the tiniest, daintiest filigree of small brush strokes, a blade of grass arching in a breath of wind, an ink on paper where the ink soaked through to where we meet. Reaching. I could be a poem. Like water that reflects the me that you see and changes each time you read it, crafted in language so open that I remain able to move and change within the words. In that case, I might not make sense. Learning. I could be a forest, a meadow or a tide pool, a desert or a tundra. I could be a puddle of muck that's just forming into moist possibility. I could be a mushroom holding the communication between trees. Living. In each of these, I am described in a set of messages that explain and confirm one another, messages that sing to each other. And when we meet, you will see another set of images, a woman in shoes, and accessorized in the thingish world we live in. I will dress for the occasion of our meeting in something bought in a store that covers me in a culture of signals, so you will know where to put me in your library of codes. And you will do the same. Hundreds of years of messages are flying between us. Respectable, lovable, worthy, status. But which codes have we chosen to message each other within? Which signals are obscuring the others? Can you still feel the texture of my math? Can you breathe the ink of my wool? Can you be a blade of grass with me? Implicitly, the waft of us, in the style of us, in the way we are, is the possibility of our communication. Hmm. Changing the code changes more than the message. These are portraits of possibility.
That's beautiful. Didn't feel appropriate to clap.
I was just thinking of us looking at that water dispenser and both of us like turning that little thing thinking, what is the place where you turn this, where the water stops falling on the floor? And it wouldn't turn to the place where the water stopped falling on the floor. No. And he looked at me, looked at you, and we're like, what are we going to do now?
Right. Thank you for that. I think something that I would love to get lost in with you is this topic that is prevalent in many circles where I spend time, and it sort of goes under the name of something like a worldview shift, where I hear that used in terms of sometimes as an impossibility, and sometimes with sort of a shoulder shrug. It's just, you just have to shift worldviews. Oh, that's not a problem. You know, that's no problem at all. I think a lot of how I perceive your work is that a lot of it is about that, perhaps, of offering different possibilities and new ways of attending to the world. But how would you take us into that topic from
really? Okay, that's an interesting question. It's interesting because I want to invite you to just remember some moment in your life, and it probably isn't a single moment, it's probably a sort of a swath of time, where there was real significant change. And where did that change come from? How did it come to be? What made you ready for that change? And I'm asking that because one of the things that I feel very frustrated about is the kind of ease with which we can habitually just look to the seduction of some model of a new worldview and just think you're going to implement it, like changing the tires on your car for winter. We're just going to switch out this worldview for another one. And that's inherently the same worldview. Just for the record, that's the same worldview with different vocabulary on it, but it's the same thing. So what is this? So my feeling is this, that it's like the sky is above you. And if you don't look up, you don't see it. Everything that is in this ecological world is right in front of us. You are a complex living system. Right? So I don't need to download the intricacies of complex living systems to you. You actually already are one. And your loved ones are one, and your microbiome is one. And if you step outside your door, you're in several, and your dog is, you know, so this idea that there's some elusive thing that we have to download drives me bananas. Yeah. So where is this thing? And I think that the issue is much more significant than a simple replacement part. Mm-hmm. I remember having a moment. I moved to Sweden and married a Swede. And come Christmas time, which it almost is right now, we're inching up to this time of year when our unseen, deep habituated ceremonies clash. Neither one of us even likes Christmas. Okay. So it's not like this is some sort of sacred territory. Mm-hmm. This is just culture playing out. This is just history, habit, and life memories and the depth of them. And I remember my husband walking in the kitchen and I was making mashed potatoes. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm making mashed potatoes. It's Christmas and we have to have mashed potatoes. And he was like, no, no. Christmas, you have to have boiled potatoes.
Yes.
And I was like,
I concur.
No, you can't have boiled potatoes on Christmas. It has to be mashed potatoes because you have the gravy that goes with the, you know, the. And we looked at each other like, oh my God, this is a total impasse. Neither one of us is going to budge. Okay, let me just remind you that these are two fairly, you know, sensitized, reasonable adults standing in the kitchen, becoming absolutely adamant that there will be the type of potatoes that we need to have. And so clearly we had to have both. And the Americans ate the mashed potatoes and the Swedes ate the boiled potatoes. But the thing about the example here is this notion that you can just switch this stuff out. Mm-hmm. I mean, let me tell you, you cannot just switch this stuff out. And so this, the depth of these epistemological and habituated cultural perceptions is so fantastic. And it's also where the possibilities lie. So you can look at it and say, this is what makes it intractable. But you can also look at it and say, look how many ways there are to be human. And to be adamantly, stubbornly, completely convinced that each one is the only one. There is only one type of potato that you can have. Right?
Christmas, yeah.
I'm giving that example because it's a light one. Okay, mm-hmm. Because these examples can get much heavier, and much more visceral and even violent. So I think for me, the invitation in my work is to begin to become familiar with those places where old ways of thinking are actually guiding the new ways of thinking, but are unnoticed. Where are the ghosts living? And I'm interested in that because I really feel, honestly, like you can't just decide you're going to make change. Ecosystems, all of them, meadows, families, human beings, dogs, all of us, oceans, like to continue. And the continuation requires a kind of conservatism. All right. So don't change too much or you'll stop being a meadow or a person or a dog or a, right? Your relationships will all fall apart if you change everything. But if you don't continue to change, the system gets ossified and rigid and breaks.
Yeah.
So you have to have discontinuation in order to continue. And that's where we are. So what is going to discontinue now? And the thing is that I don't want to have a top-down program on that. What discontinues for you today and what discontinues for me, what discontinues in Dubai or what discontinues in Peru or what discontinues in California, they shouldn't be the same thing. The whole issue is that there is an ecology of communication and relationships and that they are diverse and they learn and move and shift in diversities of time, diversities of texture, diversities of what's pulling them. So this idea that you were just going to download a new narrative or a new mindset is, I mean, okay, if you're going to replace your carburetor, but you can't replace a member of a family. You know, it's just not the thinking that is transferable onto living systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you said something initially in that response around sort of the vocabulary that it's even, just because we changed the vocabulary doesn't mean that we've changed the underlying and just this sort of discrepancy between, let's say, vocabulary and communication, that the same communication can live in lots of different languages. And I mean, in different contexts. At least that's my perception as I switch between both sort of Sweden, Iceland would be one part, but also mm-hmm. being in sort of new spiritual circles or systems change circles or, sustainable plastic circles. And all of them are circles where I belong and have belonging.
I'm thinking of this piece from the book called To Live in Another Way. Mm. It's short, much shorter than the one I just read. So I'll read you this one. At first, it appears that it's the parts of the system that must be made better or fixed. Then, it becomes clear that the system is not in the parts, it's in the relationship between them. So it seems like it's the relationships that need to be made better, fixed. But relationships, it turns out, are made of communication. And then the communication becomes the place to address the needed adaptations. And then you realize what's communicated is not what's expressed or even what is not expressed. It's what it was possible to express. That's where the limits move. It's in the combining. How shall I tend to the premises of what is possible to communicate? So that piece for me, I put right at the beginning of the book because I felt like this is actually what this book is it's a place where it becomes possible to communicate things that in ways that about things that around being that are not possible in most other places, mm-hmm. right? When you are in an algebra class, who is it possible for you to be? What's it possible to communicate? When you go to the doctor, when you are with some friends, who can you be? And when you're with other friends, who can you be? What's it possible to communicate? And where are those limits? And I'm not by any means suggesting that all relationships should be all expansive. No, but that those limits are interesting. And that question of where do we tend those limits? So one of the things that I am most excited about right now is that I keep getting these reports back from people that are saying, I'm reading your book. And one of the things that's happening is I'm writing so much. I suddenly am just writing and writing and writing. And I love that because it's like this second order thing has taken place where there's a space to express in a new way. And suddenly it's like there's a gush of possible expression just pouring out. So I kind of feel like I just opened the taps. And so what's possible to communicate is what allows the change.
I'm just going to go with my instinct. But so I can't remember exactly when I found your work or found my way into it. I'm sure that it was through some podcast or something like that. It might've been one, but like on Team Human or something like that with Douglas Rushkoff. And what I found interesting was that I thought that I understood what you were talking about. There was sort of language being used that I could relate to, words that I could relate to. And there was a certain recognition there or a resonance or something that was happening that kind of led me into it. And then I spent some time showing up to these the memorial of the Steps to an Ecology of Mind, the 20th anniversary of that. And then I found you speaking in a different context with different or two and or, you know, with around different people. And all of a sudden, I felt utterly lost because there was all that rigor that was coming in, and all of that sort of depth and that the depth of the study that you've occupied yourself with for I'm imagining most of your life. And so, but there's something around. I don't know. I think what I wanted to say was that there's something around to have the courage to speak simply. to point to the mashed potatoes rather than something world-altering, nefarious, scary, or whatever, something that affects us, rather than the mashed potatoes and the potatoes that opens me to something like a similar story in my household, which has been for us, Christmas in Sweden starts on the 24th in the morning. And that's a full day of Christmas. In Iceland, there is work until 6 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock, that's when you're supposed to be ready. And that's religious. And so, you know, there are all these like clashes that are there that are inexplicable. And like you were pointing to, or how I heard it around, there are these ways that we attend to it and what we prioritize, and this initial instinct to prioritize the thing or the tradition or the ritual, my thing. And then slowly softening into the relationship and realizing that there are several things that need to be tended to or been with here. And so, yeah. And again, this possibility of the communication. I mean, you notice that I've been noticing my own presuppositions in those moments more clearly than I have in technical contexts or in other, that where there is much more context. You know, in the plastics industry, you talk about only certain things. And of course, these certain things are left out because that's not our business or those are not our relationships. So those are not things that we could possibly talk about here with one another because we're not here as humans. We're here as something else. And so, I don't know. There's a lot of words, but it kind of returns us back to the who are you question and the significance of that. And then there's also something I think that I wanted to underline in terms of the courage to speak simply and with the how that in our, what I perceive in the current cultural paradigm, how the simple speak is sometimes a bridge to get dismissed or a pathway for not being taken seriously. And like, there's a trust that lives there, it seems to me, that might be worth bringing in or mentioning here. I don't know.
I appreciate you doing that because it's frustrating. I feel like I get underestimated all the time. Mm. So it was kind of nice with those Bates and anniversary sessions to have the reveal. Yes, she has actually done her homework. Mm. Yes, I can actually be in the theoretical sphere, and I can actually do that. So I choose not to, because, okay, Alfred Korzybski talked about the map is not the territory. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I see is that there has been a big interest in learning about complexity. Mm-hmm. And so we have language, we have theory, we have all sorts of beautiful intellectual rigor. But there's another kind of rigor, and that's the rigor of practice, right? When you are actually mastering something, whatever it is, it takes practice. Mm. Right? If you are going to learn how to, you know, whatever it is, bake bread, blow glass, cook stew, you can work wood. Okay. My husband is an artisan wallpaper maker, and he knows in his hands if the block that he is going to use to print that wallpaper, if that wood was grown on the north side of a slope or not. He knows which of the 50 planers on the wall to reach for. Mm. He knows that in his hands. It's a practice. So that practice of complexity is where I'm trying to invite people, because I don't think you're alone in feeling in some way excluded or disembodied or somehow outside of the intellectual academic rigor of this. I mean, I love both. Okay, so I can play in that territory, but I think it's much more important, especially given the urgency of this era, to begin to go into the practice of living it. The complexity theory is not just an academic professional tool. It's something that applies to every second of your day, every single second. And that practice is really, I mean, that's what I'm really working with. So, you know, in combining, it's about sex, it's about food, it's about parenting, it's about being in double binds in all sorts of ways. It's about money. It's about being alive. It's about aging. It's about being a child. It's about memories that change shape. It's about, right? So for me, complexity is the map, but then there's the territory, which is actually complex. So somehow the discourse about complexity is not complex. It's just in the same sort of tonality and texture of academic rigor. You could be talking about anything, abouting. Mm. But what happens when you're within it and suddenly you start to find that confusion? And I think that confusion scares people. So they reach for a modality, they reach for a model, they reach for a program, they reach for a five-step a solution, they get linear, they want to hop to the end and create, let's envision a new society, right? And I don't know. I mean, honestly, do we know where we're going? And should we know? Or should we actually do like William Blake says, you know, that he who would do good should do so in minute particulars, just tend right here, right now, and see what happens from there. So many folks that, I mean, I'm going to be visceral here for a second, because this is something that I carry in my body. I cannot tell you how many conferences I have been at where people are saving the world in one way or another, but they're stealing each other's ideas, or I find somebody's hand on my leg under the table, or I get, you know, in some way, this thing happens that is absolutely not at all what we're talking about. And if your commitment is actually to this making of a better world, what place does that have in the room? So it becomes very clear to me that just having the ideas is not enough. You have to live it. Hmm. And that's something I learned from my father, who did live it. Right? A lot of people come to these ideas through university studies. I came to these ideas by being at the breakfast table. Mm-hmm. And so the way that they were first brought to me was through process of getting through the day.
Yeah. You write something somewhere in the book around this like nuance. I can't, and maybe I need to find the quote, but let's see. But there's something around how we can only perceive nuance after we have a certain level of knowing or a certain level of familiarity with a particular context or a particular situation. And that the discernment in the nuance relies on some sort of knowing or perhaps even some sort of practice. Otherwise, we will be, we're just lost in a different way or in the same way maybe that we were lost before.
I think, yeah, this issue of the familiar.
Yeah.
And that there must be, so there's a theory in the book called aphane poiesis. And aphane is a Greek derivative that means unseen, not hidden, not invisible, just unseen. And poiesis is becoming, right? So it's the way that things become in unseen ways, coalescing in ways that are unseen. This was such a big breakthrough for me. It was like the moment when I felt like I suddenly found the backstop, the permission, the floor, the thing that was like, okay, the work here is not to, you know, do like that old story is of the drunk guy looking for his keys under the street lamp when they're actually lost in the woods. Right. So we look in the familiar places to find the change that's in the wilderness. And the thing is, it must be in the wilderness. So I'm always asking this question of how does an organism know how to evolve? This is a question that should break your head, because it's the thing of knowing how to do something you don't know how to do. And knowing that you have to do something you don't know how to do and that you never even considered is necessary as a kind of side cache of life. So that there is this way in which, really insidious, horrible things happen because you are combining. You're combining a little experience there and a little bit here and a little bit there. And pretty soon you find yourself in the common sense world of linear strategies and asking questions like, what's the point, or what's in it for me, or what am I going to get out of this, or where is this going, or how can I, et cetera. And so what's happening is that your experiences are shaping each other. And that's how you're going to find things like racism, like misogyny, like corruption, like greed, like, right, all of these deeply insidious issues that are under the ones that we're facing and that look like whatever it is, climate change or exploitation. So what's in the underbelly of that? What's happening in the underground? What's coalescing? And does that same coalescing produce life? And then you're asking, what are you side-by-siding? What are you putting together so that that combining is the issue? And be careful not to think you have to actually see it, because everything that comes into our habituated perception gets metabolized into our habituated perception. So how do you see something new? And this is where art is really important. This is where being in cross-cultural situations like the potatoes or your Christmas issue is really important, because those are the moments when there's a hole. There's like a snag in the tapestry. And you realize, oh, there's more than one way of being human. What's important about that is not then to chart the way that's possible, but to recognize that there is a wilderness that can happen. So for me, it's that wilderness is where the hope is sitting right now. It's the weird things, the unexpected things, the possibilities we did not see coming that are the ones that are, I think, the most important.
I don't know how exactly, but what it seems to live also in the attention, as you're kind of underlining that it's not about necessarily seeing the change, but it is about sort of how we attend to it in some way, or like at some point something. When we met at that water cooler, it was in the context of the conversation that you were having with Daniel Schmachtenberger and then also with Nate Higgins. And I had a one question for you, which was around when is change, which to me relates to this attending. And also that what you said at some point earlier in terms of like, what's a significant change or a period of change that's been happening in my life? And usually, once I notice that it's happened, it's way later than it actually happened. And so I find that very interesting in terms of the polycrisis or the metacrisis or whatever you feel like calling it. But there is a certainty in some circles around how bad everything is going to get. And I'm wondering also sort of what are the seeds then for the for the something else, for those other stuff that are also, I mean, what else is also happening right now that we can't see, but that's also happening, that would be more a funny poetic than I imagine. And how would we know? Yeah.
And that's just it. So that's why I was saying I love that people are reading my book and they're writing, right? Because usually you write a book so people read it. But to write a book that makes people write, that it's, and it's not about writing,
right? There's not even any worksheets or something.
No, there's not even any suggestion that you should write. There's nothing about this book that is that, but it. So what's happening in that moment is a second order response. So there's something in the aphonopoetic process, in the way things are combining in the book, that has the consequence of people suddenly wanting to explore a new kind of expression. I think that's super exciting. There's nothing more I could ever ask for. Mm. And I didn't see it coming at all. never even occurred to me.
But there's also, there's a curiosity there, and probably it might even be something relating to your warm data work. But there is a difference between, again, wanting to explore and actually getting to it. I mean, there's a way that we say, I want to go out into the wilderness and I want to go camping with my kids and I want to, and then it doesn't happen and it doesn't become practice. It remains this wish, and then maybe even it's connected to this. So you buy all the stuff even, and so you're the person that has the stuff that could be going hiking but isn't really going that much, or you know. And I'm wondering about that transition into practice. Again, we've touched upon it, but I'm wondering if there's more to say around that.
Well, I think what you're kind of moving into is this question around readying.
Yes.
And how does the readying happen? So I think it's interesting to look at what makes a system ready for change as opposed to how to change it. And to somehow nourish that readying process. So buying the stuff might be one thing. Having kids, that's another thing. Mm-hmm. Having a memory, like I went hiking when I was a kid and it was significant, that's one thing. And then you get this pressure. Yeah, but your kids are online all the time. You have to get them out into nature. Okay, there's something. But then there's some weird thing that happens. I don't know what it is. You'd never know where the moment is that readying happens. And it's this X plus 1 minute thing of you're in X, readying. And then 1 minute later, you're ready. Something happened. And it's very often just a combining of things. And then there's one sort of slightly insignificant thing that comes up. The next thing you know, you're on a trail somewhere. Yeah. And so, but the thinking is what's interesting to me, because it's the thinking, not about I need to go hiking or I need to make this change or the outcome of the change will be, but the question of what's happening in my world that's producing these conditions. And I think also adding things, right? You never know whether it's going to be, you know, a conversation with somebody you have on a bus, or the moment you are helping your elderly parent walk down the stairs. I've had an interesting situation recently. I have my almost 95-year-old mother living in our house. And I also have in the house next door to us is my 26-year-old son and his girlfriend. And then there's the Swedish stepkids that are in their teens and 20s, and they're all around. And because I've had to go do some, you know, be on the road work with the book, I had to figure out, you know, who's going to watch my mom. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't like to be around people she doesn't know. And she wasn't really eligible for the Swedish system work. So to hire somebody was very expensive and also not something that she would be amenable to. So I hired my kids. And some really interesting things happened there that I didn't expect. Again, I had something that I was like, I got to go do this book launch. Can you guys watch Nana? And I set up a day and I set up the medication schedule and I did a lot of cooking and froze the food before I left. And I, you know, but when I was gone, they had to actually be in the position of caregiving. And there's a lot of learning that comes there around this is what I want to do, but this is what this person needs. And learning to see when someone needs something before they need it. And the other thing that happened was that they were around someone very close to death. You cannot tell a teenager how precious life is because they are immortal.
Yeah.
Right? So it was really interesting to see, you know, the kind of actual complete shifts that took place in our household when they were attending to her. And so they were living close to death, somebody who was dying, and it allowed them to see life differently. So here, these are examples of this readying thing. And what happens when you bring in things from different contexts, in different textures, in different ways. So I would not have necessarily anticipated that the second order effect of, you know, hiring my kids for the weekend while I went to New York to do a book launch would be that they would suddenly be able to think about their math class in a very different way.
Hmm.
But that's, I think, for me, that's what's interesting is that this tending not to first order change, but to nth order change. And so I'm excited to get better at that, right? And just even, I think, asking that question, like, what is nth order agency? How do you tend in ways that allow the change to make change to make change? So, right, it went from, I got to go to the book launch and we have a kid that's having trouble in math class. But I had no idea that those things were going to actually come together. So this is what I mean when I say there is a field, a realm, a world of possibility that's so alive. And it's just obscured by the solutioning that is happening in these very clunky mechanistic ways toward, you know, predetermined goals and linear strategies to get there. How do you get your kid better at math? Well, you make them practice and you get them, they have to be disciplined. Nowhere in the program is have them spend the weekend with a 95-year-old person. Right?
Yeah.
So this is a whole, I mean, I think it's a very interesting, it's a practice. It's a way of perceiving that actually is opening these significant systemic shifts, but they're just not where you're looking for them.
In terms of the having your kids watching or caring for, and then there is this whole aspect of the question that comes, like, what's the point? And then, I mean, kind of the point might be that there isn't a point. It's not a point at all. And also that, what I've heard you speak to as well, like the way that we draw relationships as defined, clearly defined, very thin lines between boxes. that imagery, informs us. And before you pointed to that or pointed towards that and gestured in that general direction, I'd never really considered how inappropriate it is to draw relationships in that way. And how many things are ongoing, both at dinner and that piece that you have about eating the menu itself. And what those aspects, but also, I mean, And at the same time, it seems so futile or small in relationship to the, I'm the this and that speaker of the UN and doing this and that and speaking to all of these important people and doing all of these important stuff. And I have the solution for everything in my 1,000 or 2,000 page book that, and here's the manifesto and here's the solution. And here you go, you know, just take it and go with it. And I'm thinking about when I go to the restaurant, I think about that I really kind of want to taste the menu now. Like I kind of want, you know, see if I can take a chunk out of it and see what would happen. Like, how would that, yeah. There's something very insidious, I think. And I think I use that very literally and in that, in the way that we tell these stories, in the way that we swim in the context that we are in, and that aspect of, I mean, even this idea of where I started was thinking that I would be able to do cultural change, which is, it's right now where it lives in me is that it's so wrong on so many levels to think about it in that way. And now I said levels, and so I'm wondering if that is also somewhere we could go for a little bit and speak of levels, both sort of the logical types stuff, but also just levels in general.
I mean, I think one of the things is that there is a lot of mixing up of abstractions, and they're everywhere. Where I guess out of habits of industrialism and pre-industrialism, there's a potency, a perceived potency that comes with changing the map. Mm. But as a spoiler, let me just say, the territory wins.
It's a Matrix moment. There is no spoon.
Yeah exactly. So, I love when I get to do things with Daniel Schmachtenberger because our tone is so different. Mm-hmm. And our message is not different. But the tone is very different. The complexity that we see is not different, but the way that we express it is very different. And I want to explore that more because and do more things that allow that combination to take place. Mm. You know, if we were in a band, you know, he might be playing bass and I might be on the flute, or, you know, he might be lead guitar and I might be drums. But what's necessary is the way they're holding each other. Mm-hmm. And yet we live in a world in which the quick response is, well, I like the way she talks more, or I like how Daniel talks more. He really knows what he's talking about. She doesn't seem to know what she's talking about. Other people are like, yeah, but Daniel's just always talking in this, you know, male way, and he misses all the life stuff. And that is actually not the point, right? What's interesting is to see these different forms come together. And to hear that where there's new resonances that can come through in that combining. So I love that. Now you wanted to talk about logical types. That's a dangerous topic.
But before we do,
yeah,
there's something around, because you use the term side-by-siding in the book. And so there is, I don't know, I just had this imagery in my head, whereas like where there's appropriate side-by-siding, and then it actually will take us towards logical types, I think. But there is also something around a layeredness, or like there seems to be, at least to me right now, it seems to be sort of an altitude as well on different levels. And so certain things are, even though they're side by side or on the same map, or they would also live at different, they would be difficult to mix or hard to mix or even inappropriate to mix up, or actually to side by side fully. So there's something around, just now when you were speaking about the way that you talk and the way that Daniel talks, and that how I had that reaction too. Oh, wow. This is a person that really knows, but I was always surrendering a lot of my knowing, or I couldn't fully relate to a lot of the stuff that he's speaking about to myself. And so I was kind of surrendering elevating him into that expert role. So I wasn't able to side by side myself with him. And then I see the interaction that the two of you have been having, those dialogues. And there is, as you're saying and pointing to, I'm just realizing this now, that's why it feels important to speak, but that there is really a side-by-siding happening. There is that deep mutual respect and that ability to hear things that I didn't perceive was present in the communication, but just because of the depth of your explorations in your respective fields. So there are all these like unexpected things that bubble out of that type of side-by-siding, if that is what it indeed is. I'm trying on that language, so I'm not familiar with it.
Absolutely. And it's also a bit of a meta exploration of communication itself, which is really important, because like you were saying earlier, the communication is landing in an existing set of phenomena, right? An existing set of contexts that have history, that have various grooved in pathways and habits. And so it's not, you say whatever you want, but it's going to land in a context, and the repercussions and the way that it sticks or doesn't stick or how it gets twisted up matters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this exploration of different kinds of communication, different tones, textures, rhythms. I mean, it's all very different resonances, are calling to different aspects, different phenomena. And so I think when you put side by side, this is what I love Daniel, and I love being side by side in that space, because he will call this intellect into being, and I can bring the body in,
yeah,
and home life and intimacy. And he is in government and high scales. And this, I mean, jokingly, I say he's in the Situation Room and I am in the meadow. and I love that, because it's allowing both to reveal the nuance of the other. So unfortunately, again, it's landing in a context, and that context is a context of polarity.
Yeah.
So unless we speak explicitly to this, invitation to begin to pay attention to the metacommunication going on and how important metacommunication is to the changes that everyone is hoping will come. I mean, it's probably the most important thing is the metacommunication. Until the metacommunication changes, we won't see any other change. So, and Daniel knows that. He's very acutely aware that first order change is not nth order change. And so am I. So that's, I think it's fascinating. And I hope we get a chance to really explore that more. So this book, this combining book, is not really about any of the pieces in it. Hmm. It's about side-by-siding them, which allows for the wilderness of your connections, your memories, your way of stitching these things together. And that will change. And you don't have to start at the beginning. You can start anywhere you want and move your way through. And the side-by-siding is alive and wild and undetermined. And that's what makes it rich, right? If it were a flat discourse of this is what you need to do to change the world, then that aspect of you that's actually alive would be strangled out. Okay, then it becomes a washing machine instructions. And this is where I think it's most important to tend to those ways in which we can actually make room for people to make their own connections. And that's risky because it can go in any way. No one's driving the bus. But that's not really true. Actually, if it's held in a way that's really transcontextual, life is driving. Life wants to make life. But if you take the context out and you limit the context, then what you get is side-by-siding that turns into things like fascism. And it's extra alive because, you know, like, for example, the Brexit campaign, which was built on an idea of stochastic process. So they provided a few stories and they let people make their own connections. So life used to be good. Someone's come to take away your life. And I don't know. There, another one. Let's just say, you know, immigrants are bad or something, right? And then those stories had no context in them. Because they were context-free, they ignited a response of experience, but not of context, right? So they, and then they knitted together in this way that was super alive. It was very potent propaganda. But that's essentially what propaganda does, is it gives you things to connect. And because it's wild connection, it's extra potent. Which is different than saying, we're going to tell you what to think. That generally doesn't work that well.
No.
Unless there's metaphor. And in the metaphor, you've got the gap. You've got the side by side. So metaphor can be evil. But metaphor with lots of metaphors, with lots of context in, can help generate life. That's why this book is not about how to save the world. It's about sex. It's about food. It's about, you know, everything. Because it's, if I want to share an idea with you, I need to actually bring it to the whole ecology of being that you are, right? Not just your intellect, but your body, your mind, your heart, your school memories, your, right? You're lots of different ways. And it needs to be sad and it needs to be happy. It needs to be crunchy. It needs to be funny. It needs to be weird. It needs to be, right? Because you are all those things. So this bringing together of multiple forms of communication, under them is all the same thing. Under them is this idea that life is lifing, and that we are part, we're memberships in it.
But in some way. So where my attention got stuck was both this notion that it was provided without context, so that I could fill that in myself, that the power of that. But then there was also something around. I kept wondering as you were speaking if there is there's another need for reinventing the word. So the meta communication to me, the way that at least that I spend time with the word meta right now, it seems to be kind of floating again, and it sort of seems decontextualized. And I'm perceiving in a way what I'm just wondering if I'm sure technically the term meta communication is right. And I'm just not you know, in that field enough to know exactly what it means. But there is something around the pointing of where it goes. It feels like another deracination, another uprooting of something where it feels like there's that fullness and the underlying as well as the overlying and the undertones as well as the overtones, like all of that stuff, which is just outside of our perception seems to be allowed for, or like all the stuff that's happening that where you have the skill to reveal things that are unseen. If we speak about the Afani poetic again, where, I don't know, I'm rambling right now, but there's something there that I think that felt significant to me from where I'm sitting right now.
I mean, I think the word meta got eaten by Facebook.
Right.
And okay. So we might have a legitimate allergic reaction to the term itself, because it suddenly occupied everything. And that's too bad. Because, I mean, it was a useful word. We will mourn the word. But essentially, what we're saying is that there is communication beyond what is said.
Yeah.
So, you know, in communication that is loaded with the particular tones, textures, and nuanced, factoids or derivatives that go into particular realms, there are whole associations of credibility, of importance, relevance, solidity, that this is something valid and of great need.
Yeah.
Right? And then there are other forms of communication that are going to be swooshing around and may not look important at all, but they may actually be moving things that are at the deep end of the pool. So I think for me, one of the questions that sits on this question you're asking is, why is it that so many clever people in so many offices have for so many decades known for so long so much about what's been going wrong and haven't been able to change it?
Yeah.
In fact, it's actually gotten much, much worse. So what is it? Because, you know, the people in the UN know, and the people in the, you know, that we've known, people in Shell Oil knew about the damages of petroleum, and the people, everybody knew. I mean, it's been 100 years of people knowing what mess we were getting into. It's so much like addiction, isn't it? You know, those cigarettes are bad for you, but somehow you keep smoking them, or whatever the habit or the substance is, that you know that it's going to actually destroy your relationships and your world. But if you let it go, you're going to have to let go of a huge part of your world that might destroy a lot of other things. It's a double bind. So this question of why, if everybody's so clever and so on it and so important and so potent and so powerful and so, you know, the establishment is actually able to operate at scale, what the hell's going on? Why are we here? And I think that's where I come in, mm-hmm. to say, yeah, because it's actually not living there. Right? That's the icing on the cake, but it's not actually the birthday party. And the world that wants a birthday party, or, you know, just as a metaphor, so I think that it's also, I think it's also just like there is this question of you and me and feeling like I don't have any access to the Department of Defense, and I can't make the decision to stop the violence that's taking place in the world, and I can't somehow, nobody seems to be able to get their hands on the issue and make it stop. So what can you do? And I think that is where this exploration of inviting attention and practice to not just first order activities. Yeah. No matter where they are.
maybe it lives in that question around evolution and the aspect of evolution which requires this continuation. And maybe this frantic holding on to things to not discontinue in the realms that we look at is what is causing a lot, or like is a at least a contributing factor to a lot of the other discontinuation in realms where we haven't been looking, where those acceptable loss.
And I think the great hope lies in the place we're not looking. And that's really like, I want to do something. How do I do something in the place I can't see?
Yeah. And there's so many more things I want to do. Like submerging seems to live like around here as well,
yeah.
Which is a concept that just being in the book. And then there's the whole matching and the meeting. And at the same time, I'm feeling like maybe this is we're at a point where rounding off might be appropriate.
We could do a part two.
And then,
then we could do that. And I'll give you a piece to end with.
Please.
Okay. You're supposed to just find things.
The exact right thing.
I found the exact right thing.
Of course you did.
Okay. This piece is called Juicy. But isn't it interesting that the erotic is so removed from the study of life? How? And how? And how to bring it in? There has always been a school of lovers, rigorous in their studies. They could not not see. They could not not describe life as juicy. But the bookishness held its sway on slabs of concrete and stainless counters. There is no place for lusty, mossy forests, floors, and shameless blossoms to explain themselves. The real flat earthers are the ones who make life into flat description. It will not serve now. Now we go into the breath so we can breathe. Now we go into the sensual so we can sense. Now we go into the intimacy so we are not alone. Now we go in or we go out.
And if people want to find you, the book is called Combining, and that's available on Amazon and other places, no?
All those places, yeah.
And anywhere, anything else that you would want to, where you would want to direct people?
There's the Warm Data Lab website if you're interested in, you know, doing some studies or seeing things that are coming up. You know, whatever. We're all over social media now. Just Google it.
Just Google it, right. Take the responsibility. Yeah, exactly.
Whatever you're interested in, you'll find us.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I mean, this was really great. And I'm definitely going to send the link to Daniel so he can hear us. I wish he was here to speak for himself, because I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, we were doing some abouting there, but thank you so much for leaning in and for having this messy and circular conversation.
I love that.
But yeah.